Joined on the line by Gillian Bird. She's Head of Education and Media at the DSPCA. Gillian, you're very welcome to the programme.
Great to be here on this lovely hot day.
Oh, it's absolutely gorgeous, but that beautiful weather means that an awful lot of our furry friends, our feathered friends, perhaps our reptilian friends, are going to be finding it really tough.
Yeah, they are, absolutely. And look, the advice is very simple. I mean, we could spend hours and hours and hours talking about it. But the simple advice is, look, don't bring your pet, your dog out for a walk, except early morning or late in the evening. I know sometimes they give you the eyes and they look at you and they want to be safe, but really, it's not good for them. So let them be in the shade, plenty of water, give
Gillian,
them a little
if you could
doggy.
Just move around a little bit, that would be fantastic.
Can you hear me any better now?
Oh, that's perfect. That's
that
perfect.
Better, okay. Grand, okay. So, yeah, so just basically make sure that they've got plenty of fresh water. You can make them an ice pop. You just pop a little Tupperware container in the freezer with some dog food in it, and then they've got a little freezer pop to enjoy. But keeping them nice and cool is really, really important, and making sure that they're not out exercising in the really hot part of the day.
And part of the reason that that's so important, yes, we don't want them to overheat, but if you have an animal with padded feet, you don't want their paws to burn.
No, you don't. And the sand and the beaches and things can be very hot at the moment, and tarmac on the pads. So if you're out, basically just pop your shoe off, put your foot on the ground, and if it's too hot for your foot to walk on, it's going to be very hot for their feet, because a lot of contact with the tarmac, it mightn't be hot just for straight away, but they could be walking across patches that are really hot, and they can actually end up getting burns and blisters on their feet. So it is just be very cautious with your pets.
And I saw an image actually on Twitter of a dog that had burned its feet on asphalt, and it looked horrific.
Yeah, it's blisters. It's a bit like touching the kettle or touching a saucepan, a really hot saucepan. They can end up getting very bad blisters and burns from it. And because it's they're walking on it, imagine what it'd be like if we were to burn the base of our feet and we have to walk on it. So it can be very painful and quite damaging, because they can get infections as well.
I can't believe that people are still, you know, leaving their dogs in cars, particularly in weather like this. Is this something that's often reported to you?
It is reported from time to time, but actually what is more of a concern for us, and people just have to be aware, is if you travel with your dog in the car, now if it's in the main part of the car and you've got the windows open a tiny bit, make sure you don't have them wide open in case the dog jumps out. But if you have your dog in the back, in the hatchback of the car, the circulation of air isn't as good in the hatchback in the car as it would be in the rest of the car. So if you wouldn't leave a bar of chocolate sitting in the back seat of the car, then when you're driving, I'm talking about,
yeah,
then why would you leave your pet? So
that's a good rule of thumb,
about
actually.
Yeah, so don't leave chocolate, and you certainly wouldn't leave ice cream there. But if you think it's going to melt, then so is the pet, and it's going to get very, very hot. And especially people on very long journeys, if they're coming back from their trips away or they're heading out, just do think twice before you put the dog in the back of the hatchback, because it's like a little greenhouse.
Now, I think most people would assume that if you have a dog in particular with a heavy coat, that clipping your dog or shaving your dog is a fantastic idea in the summer. But I would imagine it depends on the breed.
It would, absolutely. I mean, you can actually ruin the coats on some dogs if you trim them. It's always good to ask advice from your vet or from your dog groomer as to whether or not you think you should trim the dog with very short hair. Because some dogs have coats that are specially grown, they're part of their breed, and they really shouldn't be trimmed. So it's always good to get some veterinary advice before you start any of these things. Because, you know, often if it's very, very hot, you just need a nice shady part of the garden and plenty of fresh water.
What are the signs of heat stroke in a dog, Gillian?
So basically, they'd be very similar to us. They would be very lethargic. They often will be off their food, and they can be panting quite a bit and sleeping a lot. So if you think your pet is anyway unwell or is just looking a bit woozy, then it's always good to ring and get the advice from the vet. Quite often, a simple put them in the shade, even getting a towel and soaking it wet and letting the dog lie on the cold towel would be something that would be enough to cool them down. But it's like us, if we've been out in the sun too long, you can get a headache, you can feel queasy, you can feel very unwell. But it's always a good rule of thumb, if you're ever concerned about your pet, you know, ring up the vet, get some advice, bring the dog down to the vet.
Now, cats are independent souls. I mean, they tolerate us more than anything else. But do we need to do anything in particular if there's a cat in our house, other than to make sure it has access to water and shade?
Yeah, well, you just have to make sure the cat's not locked in a room where the sun is going to be blazing in. They can get very, very hot and they can overheat. Now, they're often a bit more sensible than the dogs are, but it is important that they do. And other thing to remember is, especially if you're opening up the windows on the first floor of your house or you're living in an apartment, just bear in mind your dogs and your cats. If you're opening those windows, it's very tempting for them to go and have a sniff at the breeze. And it's not unheard of animals to actually fall out of windows in apartment blocks. So just do be very, very conscious. It's lovely to have the air blowing through, but just be aware that our pets might not be, you know, so aware of the fact that the window just drops down to however many stories below, and especially cats that like to walk on thin little ledges and things, it's not very good for them. So just be conscious of your opening windows. And the same as I was saying about the car, there again, it's lovely to have the windows of the car wide open, but unless your dog is strapped in, which they should be in the car, it's very easy for your dog to actually fall out or accidentally jump out the window, and you wouldn't want that.
Now, fish, I know they live in their own environment, which is a fish tank, but I would imagine that you might have to be a bit mindful, Gillian, dependent upon the ambient heat in the room that the fish are in.
You do. Now, with likes of tropical fish, they usually have a thermostatically controlled temperature gauge, so they, you know, the temperature just won't get too high in them because it'll turn off the heater in it. But yes, for goldfish, there again, the water will evaporate if it gets too warm. Very, very hot, and usually what will happen is they will start swimming to the surface more if the water temperature is too hot. So always make sure they're in a shady spot.
And birds you keep in the house or birds you might keep outside?
Well, the same thing, they need to have plenty of shade, and there again, being careful if you're opening windows and letting your pet birds fly around the house. Same thing inside, they should always have some shade if they're out in their aviaries, and that can be something like even just a towel or rug thrown over the side of it, but most aviaries have a decent roof and would have some natural built-in shade. But fresh water, it's really important, and birds in particular like to actually bathe in water, so it's always nice to have a shallow little bowl they can have a little bath in if they want.
Gillian Bird, Head of Education and Media at DSPCA, thank you indeed for joining us. And if you have a pet and you're not 100% sure about how best to care for them in this heat, which is to last until Friday, give your vet a call. I would imagine they would welcome that kind of welfare check-in. IBEC has produced a keynote report on improving employment opportunities for people with disabilities, and I'm joined on the line by the author of that report and IBEC's Head of Social Policy, Dr. Cara McGann. Cara, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
The statistics on, I hate to reduce any group of people down to statistics, but around the number of people with a disability or in employment are dismal.
They are. They absolutely are. People with a disability are just over half as likely to be employed as a non-disabled peer in Ireland. And our rate of employment for people with disabilities is half the European average, with kind of putting us the second widest gap in Europe between people with disabilities and their employment rate compared to those without. So as you say, without wanting to reduce anybody to statistics, it is a pretty poor picture.
And what is it about the context in Ireland that means that we are so far behind the rest of Europe, that gap is so big?
I think it is a global issue, and there are a range of barriers and obstacles to employment that are experienced. I mean, for the individual themselves, there can be fear around the loss of a medical card or benefits. There can be prohibitive rules on the retention of benefits compared to the number of working hours, or even fear of not requalifying for their benefits if, for example, their condition deteriorated, or indeed if they lost their job. On the employer side, there can be sometimes a lack of awareness of what's involved around disability, concern about risk or even misperception of what's involved or the cost of reasonable accommodation, and indeed the fear of getting it wrong. And then within the current supports, there can be challenges around accessing those supports, and in some cases a lack of relevance of those supports for a modern workplace. I mean, the grants themselves can be administratively burdensome, with delays of weeks for payments to come through. Some grants aren't fit for purpose, like, for example, the Personal Reader Grant, which funds the recruitment of a person for a work-related reading. despite the fact that most visually impaired people use assistive technology for support, and also how grants for assistance are only provided at certain times. Ideally, you'd want a number of hours of support available for, say, key employee communications or meetings or further development and training, which can be really key for retention and progression. So all of these obstacles together may limit the likelihood of a person with a disability participating in the open labour market, or indeed prevent an employer from engaging this whole process and bringing an individual with a disability into the workplace.
Speaking about the grant systems specifically, is there any barrier insofar as you can see it, Cara, to the reform of that system and perhaps redirecting some of the funding to a more efficient, user-friendly way?
So that, I suppose, was really where we started out with this particular paper. And IBEC and Employers for Change wanted to look at that focus and direction of public funds in this area. And we engaged in a webinar, and we're very lucky to have Ministers English and Minister Rabbit, who were very positive towards this paper. So when we looked at the whole area, despite the ambition that we see in strategies for the greater employment of people with disabilities, for every €1 spent on income supports, only 2.4 cents is actually spent on employment supports for people with disabilities. So we think that there's real benefits if we expand the employment supports for people with disabilities. And we did some modelling to kind of illustrate the impact, I suppose, for an individual who maybe is in receipt of disability allowance or invalidity pension and actually moving into employment and off those income supports. And we found that the individual themselves would have a higher weekly income than if they remained on the payments. The savings to the state would be circa €5,000, and so that would mean that a person with a disability could be given an additional €5,000 in supports in the workplace, while the state would still make marginal savings. But for the individual, the benefits would be really significant in terms of economic outcomes, social inclusion, psychosocial benefits on mental health and well-being, decreased poverty and isolation, greater integration into society. For the employer, they're accessing a relatively untapped source of talent. And then there's knock-on effects for the economy with reduced reliance on supports and the individual tax and spending. So it is a win-win all round.
And I would imagine the prospect of an availability, in theory, of an additional 5,000 in worker supports might make some employers who previously may have been of the opinion, Cara, that there might be a prohibitive expense in retaining staff with a disability more well disposed to hiring.
I think it's partly an awareness around what's actually involved, and absolutely, if the supports work well, along with the awareness of, you know, reasonable accommodation actually may not be anything onerous at all, and really might only be a small tweaking to the way somebody works, or maybe having technologies in place, and that's what those supports are supposed to be there to assist with. And therefore, I suppose, there's this social model of disability that believes it's really around the societal, the attitudinal, and the structural barriers that makes an individual disabled, not their medical condition per se. So we've got to look at how do we create these accessible, equitable employment opportunities for people through those structures and those attitudes. But I think it's going to take a collaborative approach between employers, public and private, and government, a kind of a whole of government approach, so that we don't lose people from this process.
I would imagine, Cara, even if you and I woke up tomorrow morning and found that whole of government approach emerged and became embedded overnight, you're still looking at a period of time for attitudinal and cultural change in the workplace.
I think so, but I think we're at a very good point where there is appetite on everybody's side, if you like, in terms of individuals, employers and so on. And it's about how do we bring all of that energy together and you know, find a way to work towards this. But we're going to need those fully functioning, appropriate and meaningful supports in place to both encourage a person with a disability to take that leap of faith and a potential employer to engage, rather than adding blocks to the process and putting people off from getting involved.
Dr. Cara McGann, Head of Social Policy at IBEC, thank you indeed for joining us. We're crossing now to hear about a nurses' protest at the Midland Regional Hospital in Mullingar. And to that end, I'm joined on the line by Albert Murphy's Assistant Director for Industrial Relations at the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. Albert, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon.
Whilst I know that your colleagues in Mullingar may be among the first in recent times to stage a rally or protest on the matter of understaffing and excessive workload, I would imagine their sense, their feeling is replicated in most hospitals around the country.
Well, in this instance, in the protest in Mullingar, it was driven by the staff themselves because they've had enough. There's been a crisis building in Mullingar for the last over the summer months in particular, but it's been exacerbated in the last 6 weeks by the cyber attack, which the HSE has said that meant that they weren't able to process new applications. But leaving that aside, there was approximately 50 vacancies out of a total of nursing staff of 400 in Mullingar, which is significant. I'd imagine other hospitals all hospitals have vacancies at the time, but I'd imagine that in lots of other hospitals that there'd be similar discussions going on.
And a medical facility isn't in like any other place of work, in the sense that if you were running a multinational firm, Albert, and you couldn't cover shifts or you had vacancies in a particular sector, it's possible that you could stand down that area of your business for a time until those vacancies were filled. But your colleagues, those nurses that are working at the Midland Regional Hospital Mullingar, are going to have to fill these empty shifts, 50 of them, over the next 2 weeks themselves.
Yes, so what that means is that they've put out requests to agencies outside the hospital for additional nurses, and they haven't been able to get them. So it does mean that the nurses that are on duty would be stretched even further. So they have to do their normal workload, plus they also will have to cover for those lines that are vacant. So what that means is basically there are increasing number of patients to nurses, and it just compromises the care. And, it also means that personal care needs, and there's care events that are left unattended, etc. And it causes stress to our members. Obviously, they want to provide the care. Nurses want to be there doing the job. They don't want to be outside the hospital protesting. But we've been negotiating with the HSE in Mullingar for over the last 2 weeks, very intensively trying to get some solution. We put forward a number of options, and I know there weren't easy options to be put forward, and we didn't want to be particularly going down that road, but you have to cut your cloth to suit this measure. And so we asked management in the first instance to consider closing a ward or closing a number of beds in wards to reduce the activity, and they refused to do that. We also asked them to curtail some of the elective work and outpatients. Again, that's not a palatable thing to be asking, but it would have given the hospital some breathing space. The hospital, in fairness, is recruiting staff, but it's going to take time for them to come in. So we welcome the fact that there are 12 overseas nurses from India arrived into Ireland yesterday. They got their first tour of the hospital yesterday, but they go into what we call adaptation. They'd have to go through a period of 6 weeks intensive training to orientate them into Irish and HSE procedures, protocols, etc. And then when they pass that adaptation, then they will get their license to practice in Ireland. So while there are staff coming in, and it's a good thing, it's going to take time for them to be on the hospital floor, as it were.
Albert, in your view, why does it take the HSE so long to recruit nursing staff? I know this situation existed before the pandemic. There are elements of this situation in most hospitals in Ireland. There are vacancies, and vacancies will naturally arise. But it always seems to take quite a long time from the emergence of that vacancy, pandemic aside and cyber attack aside, to the filling of that vacancy.
Well, it does, because nurses, if they're overseas, they have to be recruited, and you're talking a lead-in period of nearly up to 6 months for those staff to get into Ireland, because they have to get their visa, they have to get a Garda clearance, and, you know, obviously travelling from different parts of the world to come here. Even with Irish nurses or EU citizens, it still takes 3 months for those nurses to come in. We are dealing with a situation that there is a worldwide shortage of nurses. But I think, I don't know whether there's a tension in the HSE that they're trying to save money by not spending stuff, so it actually builds up. But really, the situation now is that, you know, that there are nurses that have more opportunities in terms of they can travel to different countries now because it's starting to open up. Equally, there are more nursing posts available because the system knows that it's going to have to recruit additional nurses. So, very often nurses are weighing up their options. They may have different or numbers of offers, and they take which is the best offer. In this case, in Mullingar, the Indian nurses should have come in June. They're only arriving now in the middle of July, and for whatever reason, due to cyber attack, that's we're saying, well, we haven't been able to process, or the HSE haven't been able to process applications, which is, you know, just seems a beggar's belief, to be honest with you. So I really think that the hospital has to, and the HSE has to be over-recruiting to get the right match. That's one thing. And I think also the fact that the hospitals are busy, like Mullingar Hospital has been in constant escalation in its ED department throughout the pandemic. Anne O'Connor, the deputy HSE CEO, said that there shouldn't be any overcrowding in hospitals. Well, Mullingar has constant overcrowding throughout the pandemic. So the hospital is under pressure. I suppose the other thing which the hospital has only started doing belatedly since last week, it has started communicating with the GPs, and it's also started communicating on the radio in terms of asking people to stay away from the hospital if at all possible. But that's not always the case. So it's under a lot of pressure, and our members are under a lot of pressure. Even if they like they're dealing with COVID, and thankfully so far the COVID cases numbers are coming down. Whether that remains to be the same now with Delta
remains to be seen. Well, Albert Murphy, Assistant Director for Industrial Relations at the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, thank you indeed for joining us. We turn our attention now to Chambers Ireland, which has launched its pre-budget submission. I'm joined on the line by Chief Executive of Chambers Ireland, Ian Talbot. Ian, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. How are you doing this gorgeous day?
Yeah, great, thanks. I got out for a quick walk at lunchtime, so I'm feeling better for that.
Well, a little bit of sun on your bones always does everybody the power of good. In terms of your pre-budget submission, Ian, you're calling really for radical action to ensure the economic recovery, not only of Ireland's cities, but of its towns and, I would imagine, of its villages. What form does that radical action take for you?
Well, we wish there was a silver bullet here to solve all our problems. There isn't. And I think if you look at the issues facing different towns and villages across the country, they differ a lot across the country. We're very spread out and there are a lot of challenges there. The key things we're focused on are things like getting people living back in those urban centres, be they towns or villages. So incentives around you know, things like living city initiatives, you know, so that people can get tax breaks for older buildings so they can make them up so they become habitable. We're looking at things like brownfield development, how we can facilitate getting, you know, the old warehouse on the edge of town redeveloped for housing. And we'd like to see a national urban strategy as well to radically address the vacancies in our urban communities as well. So how do we get those vacant houses, for example, back up and running and into the system again? And this focuses on our housing issue as well as just vibrating the, you know, economic environment.
I think you're not the first organisation to call for this kind of strategic use of the existing built environment. I think, and I'm very much open to connection, between the correction, between the canals in Dublin, there's something like 1,200 vacant residential properties. And that has been the case for more years than I care to remember. Do you see anything at the moment, Ian, that would invite acting on that recommendation that you've issued?
Well, I think there's a carrot and stick approach needed here, really. What we've seen a lot is that for a lot of investors who, for example, may own one of those vacant sites, with the rate at which housing values have been increasing, just by sitting on the property and not doing anything with it, they're seeing a capital gain every year. So that's a bit of, that acts as a bit of a disincentive to actually invest in it, get it habitable, and so on. So what we would like to see is some sort of a vacant site levy that would encourage people to get things back on the market. So unfortunately, we don't like to talk about increasing taxes, but that vacant site levy may need to be more than existing ones, which are fairly nominal at a couple of percent. But, we really need these houses. And as you say, we know it's such a struggle to build new houses. We know we're also facing, in addition to funding, we're facing skill shortages and so on. We've potentially six figures of houses around the country. And we're not just looking at Dublin. We would have, for example, worked very closely with Alan Shine and Kildare Chamber as we develop this document that we released today. So we're trying to pick up what's happening around the country, not just in Dublin.
I know that your pre-budget submission has three key themes, and putting place at the centre of the debate is your first key theme, and I think that you've touched on an awful lot of its elements there. Talk to me briefly, if you would, Ian, about the climate action and inclusive and productive local economies elements.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're big proponents of the Sustainable Development Goals at Chambers Ireland and at our chambers around the country. So these are the UN's goals, not just on climate change, but around things like poverty, gender equality, and a whole load of issues like that. So specifically on climate action, we're looking at things like facilitating renewable energy, so investing in our energy infrastructure, our energy grids. We'd like to know what the plan for carbon tax is going to be for the next few years, so that people can plan properly around when they might move, for example, to buying an electric car rather than a diesel car, and businesses as well, when they might look to transfer their fleet from existing diesel engines, for example, to alternative methods. Another issue is just the planning system, and we know planning can take a long time to get moving, but we fully recognise that people need the right to object to planning going on in their area, for example, but we need to make sure that the various authorities, such as On Bord Pleanála, and indeed the judicial system, the court system, are properly resourced so they can get through cases quickly. Because the time is not on our side any longer on the climate action. And on things like the inclusive and productive local economies you also mentioned, some simple things here. We've asked for an increase in the voucher that an employer can give an employee once a year from €500 to €1,000, and that the employer might be able to split that into a couple of tranches just to get some money moving in the local economy. And we're also looking for things like an improvement in the share ownership scheme, the employment investment incentive scheme, again to encourage employers to get their employees part of the business and engaged in the business.
Well, Ian Talbot, Chief Executive of Chambers Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, the journal.ie has written a fairly extensive report on this matter. Nearly 20,000 horses and other equids were euthanised in the 10 years to 2020. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Martina Kenny. She's, of course, from My Lovely Horse Rescue, which has very strong links to us here in County Kildare. Martina, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
20,000 seems like an enormous figure for euthanisation, but particularly when you look in the context that just 27,000 were seized, given up during that time frame. So homes or rehoming were found for 7,000 horses, but 20,000 were disposed of.
Yeah, and that's probably only the 20,000 that we know of. I'm sure there's more, but it is. It's really sad for us being a rescue, and every life matters. It's really horrible for us to. We do know these things, though, anyway, one way or the other, and we do try our very best to help as many as we can that are already seized in the pound. But nowadays, because we're working with Gardaí so much and councils, so what we do is we rescue under welfare. So anything, any horse, pony or Shetland or whatever foal under welfare, we can seize with the help Gardaí. And so it seems that we seem to be doing a lot of that more than even having the chance to take from the pound. The pound, we would always call and ask, you know, who are the ones that need the most? Like, you know, we always go for, like, I suppose the underdog, we always ask, you know, who's in foal, who has a foal at foot, like mums and babies. You can't just leave them there to be killed. And then, you know, who's in foal or who's really old. And they're the ones we take are really sick. Like, we're desperate for that one, but we just can't even think. We always kind of think, well, at least the others have a bit of a chance of getting out, or those ones will never get out. So that's really what we do, as much as we can.
I suppose the primary question is that why are there so many horses in Ireland being cared for in such a way, in the first instance, that there are 20,000, and I use this word very advisedly, spare?
I get you. I totally get you.
Because it seems like that the horse population is far in excess of the ability of individual horse owners as a collective to care for.
Yeah, it really, really is. And that's the problem. And it all goes back to it's the Department of Agriculture and Council's problems. But the Department of Agriculture, you know, the 2013 legislation was made. And that legislation states that every horse has to be passported, chipped and passported. It has to have an equine premises number, and you know, there's prosecution. Who's prosecuted? Nobody. They can easily say, and we get it all the time, you know, that's why we work with the guards on that. So there is prosecution. But the problem is, they're like, oh no, I sold that yesterday or last week, and or I only bought it, or blah, blah, blah. I, you know, and also,
it's not like you're sending your logbook off to Shannon to get, you know, the tax office to change it over to your name. Yeah.
And it should be. And that's exactly how it should be. And it's supposed to be. But the law's not being enforced. And it's not up to the guards to enforce that. That is up to the Department of Agriculture to enforce that, our government to enforce that. And the problem is that nobody is really. We are trying to fight it and go, you have to do it. Our overbreeding is ridiculous. Like, you've got kids that have got a horse in now, like a little whatever horse in, €50, maybe just swapped it for a foal. They're now getting that foal, that poor horse in foal to see what comes out of her. And this is the problem we deal with all the time, you know? Horses just, they just mean nothing to these people. We also have huge breeding problems, you know, down the country. Mr. Joe Farmer, he used to, because of the foot and mouth, he was then given a grant for breeding horses because, you know, of the cows and that situation then. But now they have so many horses and donkeys, like, they're just selling them off for £10 each or whatever just to get rid of them.
What's really interesting is the regional variation in the number of horses seized. An enormous number in Limerick, and then the vast majority of those were euthanized. Significant numbers in the likes of Galway City. Not one horse seized in Roscommon.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, maybe there was horses seized in Roscommon, but also maybe they were through the guards, you know, because it's like, you know, there was I'm on a Kilkenny council for animal welfare, and at one point the council had said, oh, we only took in 5 this year, and then I piped up and went, well, actually, you took in 25 because 20 my lovely horse rescue assisted the Gardaí with.
Yeah,
there's a big difference, you know. So this is the problem. These numbers are just not very accurate. And also, they'll say, oh, rehomed. But they're not really rehomed. Most of them are going to rescues. That's not rehoming. The rescue still has to rehome and geld and chip and passport and do medical, you know, things, whatever, which all cost a lot of money. So there's a huge problem. And the biggest problem of all is identification. If there was identification, like you said, the car, or if you buy a cow, the person that sold and the person that buys both have to fill forms. Both of them have to, because it's the food chain.
Well,
we have serious issues with the horses.
Well, Martina Kenny of My Lovely Horse Rescue, thank you indeed for joining us. And you can find out more information on mylovelyhorserescue.com, and you can also find them on Twitter at mylovelyhorseorb.